it wasn't because we had this ego problem that we had to, you know, kind of compromise on. Why not? You know, I mean, we were told by our mentor, Robert Mann, in the beginning, said it's not going to work. We tried it. It's not going to work. And, you know, he came to our concert, our 15th anniversary concert, and he came backstage and he said, you know, I've always wanted to tell you this. I was wrong about the switching. It really does work. And you knew better, you know. It's like talking to your kid and saying, you know, you did the right thing, kid, you know. But it probably, with other groups, it might not work. I think, though, that in most groups, yes, it's easy to say, well, one violinist is weaker than the other. But in many times when I've heard young quartets that I'm working with where they do switch, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And, of course, who are we to say you shouldn't switch? I mean, we're the ones that did it, you know. But I think the reason that more often than not, that it doesn't work is because someone is just not really good at playing the second part. They're not good at playing the supporting role. It's like actors. My wife is an actress, and she loves doing the supporting role. She's less comfortable doing the leading role. She's really good, you know. So, and you see this with actors, even in terms of film. There are some that just have made a career doing the smaller roles. And not even because necessarily they're not as beautiful or handsome, it's just they're more comfortable doing that, and they have more fun with it somehow.
Yeah, but what I also was intrigued by right from the beginning, because also of the changing of the role, I think in my perception, the distinction between the four roles is much clearer. I mean, the Emerson Quartet is a quartet where also you know, the violist, like Larry, is one of the most prominent voices in a string quartet, you know, which I always found amazingly fascinating, especially in the later repertoire, if you have these four voices there. So then the change of first and second violin and knowing exactly what to do in what role, also seeing the interaction between Gene and you, brings out these four voices even clearer. And I find this so fascinating. And of course there are quartets like the Artemis Quartet, or people that also studied with you guys for some time. But there is this amazing distinctive Emerson sound, you know. You know, there's not after 5 seconds I know it's the Emerson Quartet, and it's not because I have spent a few years with them to study, but also there's something very distinctive in the balance of the repertoire and the viola. The viola sound of Larry, which is cut through on any dynamics. So
he's hiding there, but still there.
That's
how he does it.
Talking about somebody having amazing influence in my life.
I agree with anything you said.
You agree? Very good.
I personally, I have no idea what you're talking about.
He's of the Hagen Quartet. Sorry.
That's the way he does it.
I think that's something that we have strived for. I mean, look, it's very there are places in the music in certain pieces like Opus Long Movement, Opus 132, How to Get Back to Zion, where you want it to blend and sound like one instrument. But you know, it's not so difficult to do that. We're all playing on string instruments, and you know, it's not like trying to blend a woodwind quintet, which is very difficult to do.
Piece of cake.
But you know, it's relatively. Sure, there are tricks in how to do it, to make sure you're using the bow and the vibrato the same way and actually vibrating together and things like that. But I think when you look at the scores of, just talk about late Beethoven, for example, you can see that, or even in this Haydn quartet that we play today, you can see that the four voices are very much equal. That's what's one of the reasons that we're drawn to this particular set, the Opus 20s, are very crazy in a way, and very, very experimental. And it starts with the cello solo with the viola accompaniment, which is almost like late Beethoven.
Yeah.
You know, Beethoven starts doing that in the late works more. But when you look at the score, it's clearly four equal voices. Sure, somebody has a solo, and sure, the first violin usually has more of the virtuosic stuff, generally speaking. Which goes back to that joke, but no, anyway. But you need to have four strong players It's four actors on the stage. If you, you know, sometimes you need to know when to be in the background too. But a good actor can be very interesting to watch, even when they're not saying the line.
Well, one of my favorite stories about quartet playing comes from a cellist from the Alban Berg Quartet, who said, when I asked him, if you really want can play together, you have to leave your ego out. He said, no. You have to put your ego in.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, that's the moment of grace, when a fifth person can suddenly appear in the midst.
Yeah, I talk about that a lot in my teaching. Not necessarily a fifth person, but the sense, like if we're the quartet,
yeah.
You know, and you're playing first violin, your second violin, your cello, viola, let's say, if Larry were there, there's a sense of energy right in the middle here. And it's very interesting when I say that to a group, because I can see it immediately when it's not there.
You see it.
Well, you can see, you feel it. It's like they're playing, they're trying to play together sort of around.
There's nothing happens to me.
But they're not focused. And as soon as I say, just focus right here, I put my hand like that, immediately it happens. So it's just it's a little bit conceptual, but it's a sense of where the energy is going. If the violin's energy is going there and this one's going, no, it's not. And you don't always need to do that. You need to go off in different directions, that energy. But at certain points where you really, where it's really the ensemble, then the focus has got to be in the middle.
So that's it. That's the secret.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
One of them.
Yeah, because it's an incredibly complicated... really complicated, because what's the perception of sound? That's what we have to do with. You hear somebody else, you hear yourself, but what do you hear? What do you steer? You can't explain it, you can't measure it. So there is a perception, and you have to share that. And if you have this point in the middle, and then in the end it includes the audience as well, because everybody is fixed to that point, there's a virtual point where you actually lean your sound. And the perception, and also not talking about blending sound, leaning sound, and then the most fascinating synergies happened in that. And that's something I never understood, sort of how to explain it, what it is, but that's something magical that happens, but you have to be aware of it in this shared community that you are with the four of.
And I think it's different, what you're talking about, what I'm talking about, is different than this kind of, you know, where you're always looking around, and which I find kind of distracting sometimes, and can see that we don't do a lot. We do look at each other,
yeah.
And when we have something really that's emotional, sometimes I'll look at the person. If I'm playing with someone, I will look and direct my energy that way. But sometimes if it's a particularly heartfelt moment in the music that's mine, that's for whatever part I'm playing, doesn't have to be first violin, it could be second violin, I will turn, especially first violin, I'll turn away from the group. And almost like I'm in Shakespeare, where there's an aside,
yeah,
to the where I'm really directing my energy that way. It can be very effective. It's a little bit of a trick, but if I feel it, then it's not a trick.
Yeah.
And they feel it, then it's not a trick. It's a technique. Hopefully not a trick. It's a tricky technique. But
it's working. Great. Is there anybody who wants to ask something?
Anybody but Larry.
If not...
Emerson?
What about a name he's asking?
Yeah.
Just a moment.
We formed in 1976 professionally. And it was the bicentennial year, and we wanted to name it something American and pay tribute to you know, a composer or a writer or painter. And we went through a long list of names, and I don't know, Emerson just kind of stuck. I mean, he was a philosopher and a poet. He wrote essays. He wrote an essay on music, which is interesting to read. And he was an idealist, and I think that was part of what drew us to. And it also looked good in print and sounds good with string quartet and relatively easy to remember. We're not experts in Emerson's writing, but it seemed to work.
How do you adjust to the acoustic of a hall?
How do you adjust to the acoustics of a hall? Like, this was a difficult one, wasn't it, this morning?
No, I didn't find it difficult. I mean, it's a small hall. It's not a very live hall, but I it's an honest space. I would rather play in something where I feel like the sound that I'm producing is what is, you know, being heard, than trying to figure out, you know, what do I need to do. I mean, it's been an interesting tour, this one. We've played five concerts every third day with Evgeny Kisin, in big halls. I mean, he has a huge, you know, fan base. So we just played Friday night. We just played in the big Musikverein, you know, hall with 400 people standing in the back that couldn't even buy seats. That was just for me, actually.
I thought for Larry.
It was for Larry. Yeah, Larry's huge viola fan base. You know, and you've got the piano, so you've got to play a certain way, just to. But not that he was playing too loud. But you've got this huge piano, you know, and he's got a big sound when it calls for that. So, you know, you have to play. Even if we were playing string quartets in a space like that, you have to play differently. So this was like, I don't know, for me this was fine. It didn't feel overly dry or overly acoustic.
But you change your way of playing. That's actually the question, I suppose.
Yeah. It's all relative, you know. Every dynamic is relative. So if you're just a string quartet, you can't play that loud, you know, decibel-wise. You can't get over a certain level of volume. So if you want to make something really fortissimo, really loud, you have to establish the low end. You have to play at some point within everyone's memory. You have to play something incredibly soft so that when you play incredibly loud, it sounds loud.
Yeah. Correct. Altijd aanpassen. Alles is relatief. Je wil nog een vraag stellen? Laatste, we zijn bijna het einde, denk ik.
If there's a fifth person in the room, it's the composer. And sometimes we are. Yeah, exactly.
He is the final.
Right, and we're trying. If we change something in the score, it's only because we've tried it the way that it's printed, and we believe that we can help the intention by changing it. But we always start with what's on the page. And I find, like, I would say probably, Larry, you probably agree with me, that about at least 75% of teaching and coaching chamber music is pointing out what the individuals or the groups are not doing that's actually in the score. And, you know, why aren't you doing that? You know, why are you ignoring that? Try it. It's good. I mean, Beethoven knew what he was doing. Sometimes they need a little help, and there's room for interpretation, obviously. You know, you can say to be or not to be many different ways. You're not going to change the actual words, but you have to look at all the information that the composer has left you. And it's more difficult with earlier music because there are less directions. You know, Haydn writes even very few dynamics. You can see how it's scored when everybody plays together. Obviously, he wants it to be bigger, but sometimes there isn't even a forte when everybody plays together. He just assumed that the musicians would know that. So.
Good. Thank you very much, both.
Phil, thank you.
Phil Zetzer, thank you very much.